This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I've only read one Patrick White novel. It was The Tree of Man, which I greatly enjoyed. And ever since we started working on Leichhardt, I've been thinking, I must read Voss, I must read Voss. Well, I'm very pleased now to introduce Dr. Susan Martin, who will talk about Voss and other representations and references to Leichhardt in Australian literature. Thank you, Susan.
Hey, I promise I'm not only going to talk about Voss, for those of you not fond of the novel, joining quite a large group, I should say. But I'm going to start with a quotation from Voss. With the elegant but strong paper knife, Mr. Bonner began to tap a strip of canvas he had unfolded on the scented leather of his desk. I expect you'll consider it impudent, Mr. Voss, if I ask whether you have studied the map. Here, indeed, was a map of a kind, presumptuous, where it was not a blank. The map, said Voss. It was certainly a vast dream from which he had wakened. Even the draper suspected its immensity as he prodded at the coast with his ivory pointer. The map, repeated the German. I will first make it. This is a moment with the title character from the best-known literary representation of Ludwig Leichhardt from Patrick White's 1957 novel, Voss. Leichhardt fascinated Australian writers from a very early period. Although his most famous representation in Australian literature is Voss, Leichhardt's first disappearance, or brief disappearance, inspired elegiac poems from 1845 onwards. Leichhardt is one of the two most important white male heroes who figure in Australian fiction, and the other one is arguably Ned Kelly, and I'm just going to compare them for a moment. Leichhardt particularly populates the fiction and imagination of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century, while Kelly seems to appear more in the latter half of the 20th and into the 21st century. Much of the fiction and poetry about Leichhardt represents him as a national heroic figure, contrary perhaps to his representation in Voss, although not entirely. A lost and controversial explorer might not initially seem particularly promising as a choice for such celebration. However, like Ned Kelly, he has frequently been identified strongly as other to a mainstream English middle-class Anglican society and culture. Leichhardt, as you know, was a German national with an accent, regarded by some as an arrogant foreigner, by some of his contemporaries, and of course, as we've heard, represented as a psychotic megalomaniac in some histories, most notoriously Chisholm's. His class status was somewhat insecure, and his sexuality is ambiguous. Where the two characters do diverge in their fictionalisation and other memorialisation is in the ways that the culture has invested in their bodies. Leichhardt is a figure increasingly disembodied in the fiction in which he appears, a figure written into Lemurian novels as a trace, a cipher, and always just missed sight. Ned Kelly, by contrast, is very much an embodied figure, memorialised and represented through and in material objects like the armour, although, of course, today we're celebrating a Leichhardt material object, but the fiction doesn't tend to do that. Leichhardt's first major appearance in literature was in the premature Elegy and Song published by his friend Robert Lind in 1845. The poem was entitled Leichhardt's Grave, an Elegiac Ode, with the subtitle On the Scarcely Doubtful Fate of the Amiable and Talented Naturalist Leichhardt, whose life there is too much reason to fear has been sacrificed to the cause of science while endeavouring to effect an overland route to Port Essington. In it, he mournfully exhorted the party proceeding on the track of Dr. Leichhardt, and I won't sing it, I'm sorry. If widening on the waste ye meet the relics of my murdered friend, his bones with reverence ye shall bear to where some mountain streamlet flows. There by its mossy bank prepare the pillow of his long repose. It shall be by a stream whose tides are drank by birds of every wing, where every lovelier flower abides the earliest waking touch of spring. O meet that he, who so caressed all beauteous nature's earnest charms, that he, her martyred son, should rest within his mother's fondest arms. Lynn published his elegy in the Sydney Morning Herald and as a song sheet, as you can see, before Leichhardt's return in March 1846 allowed the explorer to prove, in Mark Twain's words, that the report of his death was an exaggeration. However, Lynn's verse turned out to be premature rather than wrong, and they were published again in the Australian Town and Country Journal in 1879, so I got a bit of extra use out of them. It is interesting, I think, that the poem assumes that Leichhardt's fate is murder rather than dehydration or disease or accident, perhaps setting a nobler end in the poem. The poem ends by likening Leichhardt to the power of science, come to illuminate the darkness of an uncivilised land. How will her pilgrims hail the power beneath the drooping mile's gloom? Sorry. When science, like the smile of God, comes brightening o'er that weary land, how will her pilgrims hail the power to sit at eve and mourn an hour and pluck a leaf on Leichhardt's tomb? In the following decades, more poetry on Leichhardt was published, on his disappearance and possible fate. William Henry Emling's 1865 poem, Leichhardt and Franklin, compares the fates of the two lost explorers. Henry Kendall's 1880 poem, Leichhardt, like Lynn's much earlier poem, represents the explorer, quite rightly obviously from today's papers, as a figure of science. Yet shall float the song of lustre, sweet with tears and fair with flame, shining with a theme of beauty, holy with our Leichhardt's name, name of him who faced for science thirsty tracts of bitter glow, lurid lands that no one knows of 20 years ago. As with some of the other poetic effusions from the period about Leichhardt, Kendall's poem can't be classed as his best work, however heartfelt. At one point he describes Leichhardt's youth. Born by hills of hard grey weather, far beyond the northern seas, German mountains were his sponsors, and his mates were German trees. Banjo Patterson, a decade or so later, has a poem on Leichhardt as well, The Lost Leichhardt, which was inspired by news of yet another expedition in search of Leichhardt, and it was published in the Bulletin in 1899. It begins, another search for Leichhardt's tomb, though 50 years have fled, since Leichhardt vanished in the gloom, our one illustrious dead. Patterson suggests that things have changed since Leichhardt's disappearance. Along where Leichhardt journeyed slow and toiled and starved in vain, these rash excursionists must go per Queensland railway train. The watchers in those forests vast will see at fall of night commercial travellers bounding past and darting out of sight. This somewhat snide poem against yet another expedition tended to be the exception rather than the rule. Increasing poetic speculation occurred on Leichhardt's fate across the 1870s and 1880s, and this was followed by a series of Lemurian novels which speculated more graphically and imaginatively on his possible end. The term Lemurian is taken from George Firth Scott novel, The Last Lemurian, from 1898, and it refers to a spate of Imperial Gothic adventure novels published from the 1880s onward and imitating successful fiction like Rider Haggard's immensely popular King Solomon's Mines. Traces of Leichhardt are found in J.F. Hogan's The Lost Explorer. W. Carlton Dawes' novel, The Golden Lake, from 1894, and Ernest Fevenk's The Secret of the Australian Desert, from 1895. In Rosa Prade's Queensland novels from the same period, the Australian state of Queensland is renamed Leichhardt's Land, so that Leichhardt is everywhere, but arguably also nowhere. These early representations lead on to the figure of Voss in Patrick White's novel of that name. The explorer is re-embodied only to be dismembered, sought in vain, and finally repeatedly described as everywhere but nowhere, as dust, as part of Australia but indiscernible. He is everywhere and in the rocks and in the empty waterholes, as the character Frank Le Mesurier in Voss says, prefiguring Voss's apotheosis. In Carlton Dawes' 1894 novel, The Golden Lake, the heroes, in search of a golden lake in a great white city, discover a tree engraved with L 1849. They immediately decide that this is the mark of Leichhardt. The lost explorer Leichhardt must have been on this very spot in the year 1849. I wonder if he got further than this. He was last heard of in 48, and he then hoped to accomplish his darling project, as he called it, which was to cross from east to west Australia. After once plunging into the interior, he was never heard of again. Poor devil. Richard Hardwick, the character, then carves his own initial H on the tree, an early act of vandalism, and the year 1878. The characters themselves are somewhat lost, and the narrator, Archie, feels, quote, "the history of Leichhardt and his untoward fate added not a little to the general gloom of my spirits." There was something ghostly in the knowledge that he had trodden that very spot so many years before, and that the sole relic of him was the half-obliterated carving on that tree. When their camp is attacked by Aborigines, they decide to bury their fallen comrade Murphy at the foot of Leichhardt's tree. On digging the hole, they discover a skull, which they identify as that of a white man, possibly even Leichhardt. The sight then becomes even more uncanny for them. The moon now shone out brightly and illumined the great white gum with a weird glory. It looked like some strange ghostly figure, grimly watching over the forms of the departed. I felt an indescribable loneliness possess me, a terror which I could not control. The great carven letters stood out like hideous gashes on the white gleaming trunk of the tree. L 1849, H 1878. Hardwick saw them too, and he cried out with a strange laugh. Sorry, I'm left-handed. I keep hitting that with the wrong hand. If I were a superstitious fellow, I should believe I had carved my own tombstone. In that novel, Leichhardt is a haunting absence. Their premonitions do not come true, however. As it is a Lemurian novel, they do discover evidence of a lost race, a lost white maiden with golden hair, treasure, and a volcano. Although not quite the magical white city that they had been looking for, that turns out to be a kind of rock formation of white quartz. No further sign of Leichhardt is encountered. Ernest Verwenck followed his romantic historical work on explorers, including Leichhardt, with an exotic fictionalisation of him in The Secret of the Australian Desert in 1895. In 1888, Verwenck published The History of Australian Exploration from 1788 to 1888, compiled from state documents, private papers, and the most authentic sources of information, issued under the auspices of the governments of the Australian colonies. As Melissa Belanta points out in a recent article, Verwenck used his identity as an historian of exploration and sometime explorer himself to give an aura of credibility to his novel. Some editions include maps of the fictional terrain traversed, and Verwenck includes a preface in which he argues for the likely route of the Leichhardt party. He comments, "I have taken the liberty of changing the names of some of the members of Leichhardt's party, but the descriptions of the physical features of the country are faithful records from personal experience." As Belanta and others point out, considering the fantastic volcanic caves and, again, active volcanoes, always popular in Lemurian novels, lost tribes, cannibals and gold deposits he installs in Australia's interior, this is an astonishing claim. The sequence of Verwenck's writing from history to fiction was hardly coincidental. In his preface to the novel, Verwenck comments, "Oxley, Sturt, Mitchell, Kennedy and Stewart have left deathless names on the roll of Australian explorers, but the unknown fate of Ludwig Leichhardt has always centred most of the romance of story about his memory." In Verwenck's Secret of the Australian Desert, the unattractive heroes, Morton, Brown and Charlie, with an Aboriginal man called Billy, go exploring in the interior. As is often the case, they discover a different race of Aboriginal people, a stock plot element, as I said, as is that volcanic activity they encounter. As they progress into the outback, they find traces, marks on bodies, on trees, as in the Golden Lake, and on the earth, which they interpret as signs of white presence. And this is probably, in fact, from Lansdowne's expedition rather than Leichhardt's. Eventually, they find an elderly white man, Murphy, who they identify as a member of Leichhardt's party. Unfortunately, when they attack in order to liberate him, he manages to say only, "Yes, Englishman, white man," and then die. There are some relics of the Leichhardt expedition in the cavern where they find this man, but it quite rapidly collapses on the Aboriginal tribe and a set of Aboriginal captives that they have. They rescue a pocketbook, which offers a handy textual account of the fate of Leichhardt's party and three survivors, Murphy, Kelly and Stewart. They speculate on whether Stewart can have survived with the friendlier tribe to the north, captives from which were about to be eaten when the cavern collapsed. Their conclusion about this is about the traces and marks that a white man will leave on the country. "I think if he was still alive, he would have trained his tribe up to fight these cannibals and probably have wiped them out before now and rescued his comrade." They make multiple copies of the journal, which is transcribed in the narrative, as you can see, and gives a fictional account of the failing Leichhardt expedition pursued by Aborigines and the death of Leichhardt from a musket wound. As in Vos, 50 years later, the explorer is left unburied. The fictional journal says, "We left him there on the big plain, where I think no living thing ever comes or ever will come since we were there." And thus he is part of the landscape in that novel. A fire passes through the area behind them shortly after they've left him and is assumed to have obliterated all trace of him and all trace of the expedition materials and horses and so on. The explorer protagonists of the novel continue and find traces from the remaining Leichhardt party member, Stuart, and the rest of his journal, as well as evidence, as in Fugitive Anne and as in the Golden Lake, of a superior race of people once resident in the interior. As with the Golden Lake, although artefacts and even the account of Leichhardt's death are found, Leichhardt is not. In this novel, as in Francis Webb's poem Leichhardt in Theatre, from starting in 1947, and in Vos, Leichhardt's absence is the thing that guarantees white presence and belonging in Australia. The Lemurian novels cement this by having Leichhardt somehow transcend and outlast more transient Aboriginal homes and occupations. His disembodiment, uncertain traces, bodies of his companions, accounts of him, scattered over the desert like Voss's letters, make him ineffaceable. Robert Dixon, an illustration from Secrets of the Australian Desert. Robert Dixon sees the Lemurian novels as rehearsing anxieties about racial and cultural degeneration, threatening the unformed identity of white Australia. Leichhardt's status as permanent but elusive trace in these fictions transcends the dangers and degradations attributed to some members of his party, the found explorers. He might be seen, even in The Secret of the Australian Desert, as a guarantee of ownership of the landscape. Leichhardt's disembodiment is also in perfect accord with the making of imperial space in Australia in which he was involved. Critic Simon Ryan argues that the cartographic eye of the explorer narratives produces an Australia in the 19th century which is empty, measurable and available. The explorer gives a point of view which is both monolithic and disembodied. His self is made up by his authoritative gaze over the objectified landscape. The viewer provides authority but is less important than the view. The imperial project is served then by the disembodiment of the explorer, of the narrator of that space, and continues to be served by it even in the instance of that disembodiment becoming literal. The explorer, in other words, was not necessary to the success of the exploration. The narrative was. The disembodiment of Leichhardt in subsequent fiction might be seen as perpetuating this kind of imperial space, the continual rewriting of the Australian interior as empty and yet always and already haunted and therefore somehow occupied by the explorer figure. Like most explorers, of course, Leichhardt is also a ubiquitous mark in the place from which he is absent, as a name of a Sydney suburb, a river, a mountain range, a Queensland town, and various plants. This absent presence is perhaps most persistent in Rosa Prade's renaming of Queensland as Leichhardt's Land, as I mentioned, in the series of novels including Fugitive Anne and Outlaw and Lawmaker. In the introduction to Outlaw and Lawmaker, Prade comments, "Anyone who has travelled through Australia will identify the Leichhardt's Land of these pages, though in the map it is called differently. With that colony in which the explorer Leichhardt met his tragic fate and to a part of which he gave his name." Prade misspells the name consistently with one H. I like to read that as a suggestion of the kind of missing H at the centre, but you might see that as literary overreading. It is interesting to speculate on the effect in the 1880s and 1890s of Leichhardt's Land. The replacement of the Queen in Queensland with Leichhardt was a nationalistic, even republican gesture. In Fugitive Anne, the boat from which Anne disappears, apparently slipping out a porthole. There's a giant turtle in the novel, which I don't go on to talk about, but that's why the cover. The boat from which Anne disappears, apparently slipping out a porthole, is called the Leichhardt, and Anne's travels and the search for her echo faintly the passage and searches for Leichhardt. That the boat Leichhardt is a vessel carrying that desired but elusive thing Anne is interesting. In having her heroine carried by the Leichhardt, and believed dead, Praed may be constructing an elaborate play on the fact that Ludwig Leichhardt, on his spectacular return to Sydney in 1846, after having been missing, believed dead on his first major expedition, arrived on the schooner Heroine. Anne is missing, believed dead, but is more present absence on the boat, having become invisible by cross-dressing by race and gender. She's dressed up as a young Lascar boy and she's still on the boat. The vessel Leichhardt is container here, both for the indeterminate figure of Anne and the masculinity-affirming male negotiation going on between her big white bully of a husband and her big white Danish future lover. Once Anne disembarks, they remain aboard the Leichhardt and steam up the Endeavour River to Cooktown, a journey which has the kind of imperial masculine overtones, I hope you'll agree. Following the Lemurian novels, Leichhardt's literary representations reverted to poetry for some time. One of the more famous of these is Francis Webb's dramatic poem, Leichhardt in Theatre, which was published under that title in 1952, originally titled Leichhardt's Pantomime and published in 1947. It opens with a description of Leichhardt in a waxworks. And here we find him, the magnificent doctor, comes splendidly home to the dark places of his dreams, petrified with greatness, so formidable, while time, books, death and children in little fumbling waves flicker up vaguely, bubble and slither away from his granite, sharp, black and white. The poem covers Leichhardt's youth, what are called the first expedition, the second expedition and the third expedition, as well as his afterlife as a statue, a waxwork and a public performance. Like other literary versions of Leichhardt, the poem projects the death of the party, although so this is the second expedition. It's a bit difficult to follow, but I'll read out a section of that. They straggle northwards into tropic rains, the doctor preferring to sneak up gradually on the western arm of the compass. They slush through rain on melting ground, waist deep in distended streams. They sleep on water, touch of food or leather is hand on a reptile. The cattle and sheep stampede again and again, and unofficial miles are notched in hardship. A vapid trickle of fever seeps into the men. They brandish at each other dulled edges of words. The doctor makes a speech, and Providence, hostile leaguer, stands unmasked, slouches off in the rain, gnashing teeth. The intrepid doctor is kicked by several mules. At length, the cattle, sheep, goats and all decamp on a private trek of their own sponsoring. Food supplies are low, men sick, half-starved. The doctor is detected by lamplight, head thrust forward, wild of eye, hand in the precious sugar bag. Bailed up, roundly asserts his duties to Australia and the men, extols the dignified doom of sugar replacing energies that leadership must dissipate. He makes another speech. The expedition sinks to a watery grave. You might see that as informed by the Chisholm vein of explorer narratives. Webb also wrote on the explorer Edward John Eyre in a long poem called Eyre All Alone in 1961. The critic Michael Griffiths has argued that Webb's poem offers a challenge to mid-20th century myth-making involving figures including Leichhardt. It is as a suffering human being that Leichhardt, in the end, has most dignity. This is Webb's greatest challenge to an audience who are only satisfied with a stage figure onto whom they can project their hates and loves. And there's another section of that poem. Which brings me to Voss. Leichhardt gets a bit of a rest in Australian fiction between the 1900s and the 1950s with the publication of Patrick, well, that is fiction as opposed to poetry, with the publication of Patrick White's Voss in 1957. The novel was first published in Britain and the United States, received good reviews in Britain and established White's reputation there, arguably, though he'd already had some international success with The Tree of Man. Voss received mostly lukewarm and qualified reviews in Australia, according to the critic Smith, probably because of its high modernist style, which has proved unpopular, certainly with my students over the years. Voss is ostensibly based in part on White's reading and interpretation of Edward Eyre's journals while White was in London, White's experiences of the Middle East during World War II, and his experiences as a jackaroo when a young man. He also read Ludwig Leichhardt's journals and letters, although after today I'm wondering exactly where and how he read those, and obviously contemporary accounts of Leichhardt. I believe the recently opened up White archive shows notes that White made on Leichhardt from as early as 1939. Manning Clark credits him with redeeming and repopularising Leichhardt through Voss. Patrick White was also influenced by histories of exploration, as I said, in particular, sadly, in this company, by Alec Chisholm's notorious Strange New World, which represents Leichhardt as psychotic, really. Jerry Wilkes claims that White combined these accounts with his own experience of, quote, traipsing backwards and forwards across the Egyptian deserts, influenced by the arch megalomaniac of the day, Hitler. Unlike the other fictions I've been talking about, Voss does not purport to be exclusively about Leichhardt, although the fact that the explorer hero of Voss is German, a natural scientist, takes a route that can be related to Leichhardt's and disappears in the interior, and also parallels with some of the characters you might see, Palfrim and the ornithologist, as being very much like Gilbert from the earlier expedition, have all pointed towards a parallel between Voss and Leichhardt. Ermtrud Peterson suggests that Voss is based on the image of Leichhardt which prevailed at the time the novel was conceived and written, so not based on Leichhardt, but based on an image, which is an important distinction. These interpretations have been enhanced by the packaging of the novel. If you look at this edition, Penguin edition from the 80s, and compare it to this drawing of Leichhardt, you can see how it's been marketed as being Leichhardt. There's even an academic article called The Vossification of Ludwig Leichhardt, which suggests it's become almost impossible to consider Leichhardt apart from the novel, but I think today has proved that wrong. In Voss, a German explorer gathers together a rather motley collection of individuals, a poet, a worshipful simple boy, a devout ornithologist, an ex-convict, and some other individuals governed by baser desires. Voss is driven to explore the interior and, sponsored by the bourgeois businessman of Sydney, heads gradually away from the settled districts and further inland. The novel is highly modernist in form and has frustrated and delighted readers with its echoing pronouncements. Voss says, for instance, "I will cross the continent from one end to the other. I have every intention to know it with my heart." And to make yourself, it is also necessary to destroy yourself. While he progresses across the country through ever more difficult and metaphysical territory, Voss also forms an attachment and proposes to Laura Trevelyan, the niece of his principal sponsor. But through metaphysical transcendence or hallucination, Laura accompanies the expedition on part of its final journey. The journey is one of internal examination, not just of the country, but also of the individuals in the party, and by extension of the Australian nation. Some of the pronouncements that Voss makes are against the lack of knowledge or exploration of the country, which also stands in for a kind of self-examination. "A pity that you huddle," said the German. "Your country is of great subtlety." With rough persistence, he accused her of the superficiality which she herself suspected. At times, Laura could hear her own voice. She was also afraid of the country, which, for lack of any other, she supposed was hers. Voss's own penetration into the country results in his being humbled and achieving his own self-awareness and finally destruction of himself and all but one of the party. Voss is decapitated in the novel by an Aboriginal member of the party called Jackie, big surprise, under guidance from an Aboriginal group who has followed the explorers. The death of Voss in the novel is replete with Christian symbolism, but also fits with most other fictionalisations in that his death installs him permanently in the landscape. "The head thing knocked against a few stones and lay like any melon. How much was left of the man it no longer represented? His dreams fled into the air, his blood ran out upon the dry earth, which drank it up immediately. Whether dreams breed or the earth responds to a pint of blood, the instant of death will not tell." By the end of the novel, Voss is a bronze statue, safely installed in the history books and in the public imagination. The closing pages make a number of further cryptic pronunciations on his status. The blacks talk about him to this day. He is still there. That is the honest opinion of many of them. He is there in the country and always will be. If you live and suffer long enough in a place, you do not leave it altogether. Your spirit is still there. And another character says, I'm convinced that Vos had in him a little of Christ, like other men. If he was composed of evil along with the good, he struggled with that evil and failed. Simon Turing argues that White uses the explorer journey as, quote, an excuse to imagine a highly sexualised community without women. If this is the case, White gratuitously inserts and asserts Laura as a heterosexual alibi for Vos, and she's central to the journey. Laura, although so connected to Vos that she falls ill and almost dies in his final days of agony, lives on to continue his legacy and to raise an adopted daughter, assumed to be Vos's, and indeed, you know, in the metaphysical narrative of the novel, she is Vos's. More important are Laura's pronouncements on Vos's legacy. Some of those I just read come from Laura, who places him in the landscape through such observations. And she finishes the book with the almost final pronouncement. Vos did not die. He is there still, it is said, in the country, and always will be. His legend will be written down eventually by those who have been troubled by it. I'm going to finish by looking at a popular representation of Vos as much as Leichhardt. In a recent discussion of the canon of Australian literature, Ken Gelder sees that literature as a category produced through identification with high art literature rather than popular fiction. One of the interesting things about the trajectory of Leichhardt as a literary subject is that he traverses those fields chronologically. He goes from popular fiction into the more high art fiction in the 20th century, such as Francis Webb's Poem and Patrick White's Vos. So in this sense, Leichhardt might be seen as having been elevated to the literary canon from the popular in terms of his literary and cultural representation. Both forms of literature, though, I'd argue, work to install Leichhardt as a mythical figure, important partly because of the stories told about him, whose place is there still in the country. However, such mythologising in Australia is almost always subject to larrikin response or tall poppy syndrome, so I want to give the last word to an even more removed version of Leichhardt, that in Randolph Stowe's 1967 novel Midnight. This novel makes fun of Vos rather than Leichhardt and of the mythologising of Leichhardt through Vos. Midnight is travelling through the outback, naming every waterway he encounters after Queen Victoria, when he comes upon another explorer called Smith and Smith's two camels, Sturm and Drang. I too am exploring, says Mr. Smith. I am exploring me. How can you explore you? Asked Midnight. I will not explain, said Mr. Smith. You would have to be me to understand. Mr. Smith has named the desert the cosmical symbolical desert. Together they travel to a place full of bones. It is the end of the outback, Mr. Smith explains to Midnight, where come poets and explorers to die. Sturm and Drang immediately lie down and expire. Midnight asks Smith why, and he answers, because they themselves exploring finished have. Then he shouted something in German and fell down in the bones, dead and smiling. And there I want to leave Leichhardt, at least fictionally, again, lost in the desert, but at least smiling. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Susan. And the subtitle to today's presentation was, of course, The Man, the Mystery, the Science, the History. And, of course, it's the mystery of Leichhardt which gives so much power to these representations in literature. I mean, if he had have got through to Swan River, well, OK, we'd remember him like Sturt or Mitchell or one of these, and he'd hardly be worth putting into these sorts of works of fiction. But it's because he's really still out there and he's still in our imagination somewhere that people continue to refer to him via the fictional mode. So, some questions for Susan. Russell. If you could just introduce yourself, Russell, please, when you ask your question.
Russell Wenhaus, I've just got an interest in Leichhardt. I'm aware of Matthew Higgins's procrastination on reading Vos, and I brought along this quote today to give him, to tell him that he needn't bother. And it's from Andrew Marr's biography of Patrick White, And White reportedly said that, concerning the character of Voss, there's bits of Leichhardt, bits of Eyre, and I suppose some of the others. But there is more of my own character than anyone else's.
A comment, Susan?
Yeah, so as I was saying, you know, it's Leichhardt and Voss, or Leichhardt has become, you know, seen to be the only explorer figure being depicted in Voss. But as White says, and as other critics have argued, he certainly drew on all sorts of explorer narratives and accounts for the novel. And, yeah, David Marr's quotation of him there proves that certainly White was arguing against that simple parallel of the two.
I really liked your word, vossification, too. I'll remember that one. Another question? OK, well, thank you again, Susan, for your presentation.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.